Welcome to Mission Driven, a conversation about how startups leverage their social mission as competitive advantage. Mission Driven is hosted by Better Ventures, a seed stage venture fund in Oakland, California, backing entrepreneurs using science and technology to address the world's biggest challenges. You can find us on the web at better.vc and on Twitter at Better Ventures. Miriam Rivera, Ulu Ventures. Great to chat with you today.
Rick, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
We first met your co-founder and husband, Clint, long ago. I think it was because we co-invested on something. We've had at least two together, right? But we were reading his blog posts about portfolio construction. And you all have some really unique stuff, approaches, which we're about to get into here. But it sparked quite a conversation in our firm, you know, essentially less follow-on, more big investment up front, and all the sort of math that goes around that. And that sparked a big conversation about portfolio construction for us. And he ended up joining our advisory board, et cetera. And so we've known him for a long time. And then I think somewhere along the line, we met and got to know each other. And we've been friends as a firm and as people for a while now. So I'm super excited to have this conversation. Yeah. So do you want to just maybe say a bit about your background and how you got to where you are? It's quite a distinguished path you've taken.
Well, before Ulu, I was the first vice president and deputy general counsel of Google Legal. I did a JD MBA program at Stanford. I'd worked in technology. I'd been a startup founder, which they actually really liked. They liked the fact of like somebody who would be a lawyer, but have had enough experience with like not being able to make payroll that you might actually try to do your job faster and get the money in the door easier. Mm-hmm. So that was an important part of why I ended up being hired as the first commercial counsel for Google. And prior to that, I had a separate career in higher education, not for profit. I came to Stanford as a undergrad on a full scholarship, first generation college from Chicago, Illinois.
Got it. And you also have an MBA?
Yeah, JD MBA.
Okay, great. And then talk about the startup. What was it doing basically that you were working for?
Well, we were basically doing decision analysis and software.
Ah, well, there you go. So all right.
We've been doing this a while together. We've probably worked about 17 and a half years together in that startup and also at Ulu Ventures. And we were taking decision analysis and helping companies in biopharma and oil and gas and even higher education apply it to risky recurrent decisions at that time.
Also, I think you're being a little modest here too. Didn't you, when you were at Google, wasn't it, you know, during the IPO and pre-IPO and all of that? So you rode the wave big time, right?
I like to think that I rode the wave and I helped to create the wave.
Yeah.
I basically helped close $14 billion worth of revenue and worked on the largest transactions in the company's history, including like a $5 billion commercial transaction partnership between AOL, Time Warner, and Google, and worked on a lot of the early deals. You know, I basically helped work on some of the advertising syndication first deals, helped to create the business model there. I wrote the first terms of service for Google AdWords.
Yeah, wow.
Pretty early days.
Exciting. And when you say syndication, is that AdSense or is that something else?
That's AdSense, yeah.
Got it. Probably not called that anymore.
Yeah.
And my perception is that's really helped you in your venture work, having connections and deal flow and all the alumni from Google and that sort of thing. Has it been that way?
I certainly think that it's been helpful. And also just the experience of helping to build a company from... Mm-hmm. You know, a relatively small company when I joined it was 160 people to about 15,000 people and from like 80 million to $10 billion. I think some of the, you know, learnings that you have, because I was building my own little firm within a company. I basically hired, I was the second person in legal, and then we brought on like 150, 160 people in the time I was there over 5 years.
In the legal group? Wow.
And just in legal alone. So like scaling and understanding some of the challenges and cultural issues and other things that happen in fast growth startup companies. I think that's all been helpful in addition. And then, you know, just in general, like all companies, if you're successful, have these make or break partnerships often with big players or customers. And so I think that's something that I help a lot of founders to be able to negotiate those early make or break the company deals.
Mm-hmm. All right, good. So then talk a bit about Ulu. First, cover the basics, like how big is it? What fund are you on? What's your typical check? Your stage? It's mostly seed, right, still? And the categories you invest in. You want to talk a bit about that?
So Ulu is a Silicon Valley-based information technology-oriented firm. We have been in business for about 15 years. We're on Ulu Fund 4. We have over $300 million in assets under management and are growing. We are a seed stage focused mm-hmm. firm. Almost every dollar is at pre-seed, seed, post-seed, and some A, but predominantly seed. And our typical check size in Fund 4 will be $2 million.
And then talk about the number of companies in each fund's portfolio, or in your study, your current strategy in terms of your current fund's portfolio and your follow-on strategy, because I think that's, aside from the decision part, which we're about to get to, those are both pretty, a little bit different than others.
Our funds have ranged in number of names from like 60 to over 100 per fund. We believe that with the level of risk at our stage, you actually need to have a large portfolio construction. And that has been true for every fund that we've had. So like our target for Fund 4 will be to make about 90 core investments in the fund. And then, you know, to be controversial, I think my partner Clint would say that we have zero follow-on in our companies. And that would be true in the sense that we have no committed follow-ons on a per company basis, but we actually follow on to all of our companies where we believe we can achieve a 10x probability weighted multiple in that round. And so what happens, though, that's really different from traditional venture is that we're often not following on into the winners in our portfolio. And, you know, everybody has that like double down on the winners is kind of an idiom, if you will, of venture capital. And it's kind of the common wisdom. But what we're trying to do is be a pure play seed firm. For us and our LPs, what they're looking for is growth over time in their portfolio and in their endowment value. And we think you can achieve that best by having part of your portfolio at high risk, high reward, which is what we're trying to achieve on a risk-adjusted basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can think of, in the case of Sail Internet, where we co-invested, I think you guys did follow on. And does this sound about right that they were a little misunderstood there for a bit? And I think what Clint always said was like, well, if it's a hot, you know, a properly priced round by a good investor, then like we don't have much business investing in that. But if it's like not quite do it, you know, if it's a good company and it's not getting the investment it needs, then we might write a check. And I think in that case, he was pretty much right. Does that sound accurate in terms of a time when you would follow on?
Right. Because what we tend to see is that the prices of companies go up before their risks come down. And so oftentimes, the hot company is being priced extremely high, and there really isn't as likely a similar level return to what we're marketing to our LPs, which is that 10x probability weighted multiple is a real possibility. And I think for the average firm, they typically want to double down. And what will happen is that each follow-on investment having been made at significantly higher prices will be of a, you know, relatively high paid for trying to maintain their position in terms of ownership. Whereas we're looking at our ownership and allowing for that dilution over time from the get-go. So we know we're going to get diluted, but we bought enough of the company that we believe it will still generate the possibility of returning the fund.
So I think most investors, when they attract a follow-on investor like a Sequoia or a Greylock or a Lightspeed, they think, ooh, this is the time to really double down. And I think you've had probably all of those firms invest in your companies, and you sort of stand back and don't invest when someone that prestigious comes in?
Well, you know, a lot of the times we have been, if we still see that 10x probability weighted upside, we're going to invest.
Okay.
We certainly have invested in some of our companies when Sequoia's invested in them as well. And usually that's where we've brought the opportunity to Sequoia.
Yeah, right. Okay. So say a bit about your approach and what you look for in founders and the decision analysis approach you have.
So we're looking for probably all the same things everyone else is in Silicon Valley, right? You're looking for a company that has a potential to be an outlier, and that's typically a company that can reach $1 billion in revenue in, you know, let's say a 5 to 10 year period, and where you think it, well, first of all, you want it to achieve $1 billion valuation in that time period, and then, you know, that they're going to actually be able to generate that kind of revenue in that similar horizon. So that's what we're looking for. In terms of our founders, what we're looking for is typically diverse founding teams is one of our hypotheses of how we're going to generate superior returns. And that is very typical in our portfolio. Like our Fund 3 portfolio would have 90% of our companies having a woman, a person of color, or an immigrant on the team. And that is something that we think is, you know, well studied and well correlated with actual financial outperformance. When we started, though, there wasn't any data about this in the private sector. It was predominantly from public companies and also from public company boards. And the boards and the companies that tended to have more diverse leadership teams tended to be more successful. I think over time, over the last 15 years that we've been investing with that thesis, in particular, I think Harvard Business School professor Paul Gompers has demonstrated the correlation between diverse teams and financial outperformance in privately held companies. And also the Kauffman Fellows Research Center has done some pretty interesting analytics around 20 years worth of venture returns, looking at perceived diversity of founders, and also found that positive correlation between early diverse teams and early diverse hires. So if you get more founders that are diverse and more C officers that are diverse, those venture-backed companies have tended to be more successful.
Yeah, indeed. And then that feeds, that dovetails with your decision analysis approach, because it does sort of control for bias a bit. But do you want to talk about the decision analysis approach, like what it is, an example or two of like what you're looking for in that analysis, and how it helps to reduce bias?
So decision analysis is a methodology that was developed at Stanford University by Professor Ron Howard, also applied at Harvard University by the Harvard Negotiation Project. The most important thing to understand about why we use decision analysis is that we believe it's the best way for looking at highly uncertain and risky investments in the earliest stages where there's limited amounts of data and where bias can creep into that decision-making process. From an analytic perspective, what we do is go into a room. It's now a virtual room with a virtual whiteboard. It used to be a physical room with a physical whiteboard. And we're going to do what we call a market map of a particular company's opportunity. And that is a place where we're going to be in conversation with the founders in a very transparent way. And one of the things that's going to happen after we run the analytics is that we're going to share our model with the founders. We're going to explain the model, and we're going to give them the opportunity to do what-if analysis on that model and whether we invest or not. And I think that's one way that we're holding ourselves to a level of transparency and accountability that we hope will help us reduce bias in our process, because all of our assumptions are in that model about, well, what do we really think about this company? What do we think about this team? What do we think about their chances of kind of achieving early stage success? All of that's going to be in there. But first, it is a look at like what the business model is, what we think the growth opportunity is over time, what we think the exit potential is for that company based on market comparables, how much dilution we think we're going to suffer. And so we're looking at the risks in that investment in terms of the team, the product, all the stuff that all venture capitalists are going to talk about, team, product, financing risk, and whether the market's going to actually adopt the technology. And then we're putting that into a risk-adjusted model to see if it can achieve our hurdle rate.
Yeah. And say a little more to illustrate it, because I've seen some of your models. They're really cool. But you're literally putting a number on like how likely is this company to get from like the early adopter phase to the mass market phase? And how likely is it that these founders will stay together or break up? Or maybe I'm mischaracterizing, but you're getting into like many factors, right? Like dozens of them. And putting numbers on them, right? And yeah, it's a big formula. And so like illustrate one or two of the things you rate. And like how that really makes a difference between the way the decision you would reach versus a firm that may just, I think most venture firms largely shoot from the hip and go on intuition.
Well, the reason we put numbers to it isn't because those numbers are going to be right. I think it's because it helps us to learn more how accurately and to calibrate ourselves and to calibrate ourselves as teams over time. And it also helps us to develop proprietary benchmark data that we use in future decisions around companies. So there's a variety of reasons of like why we're putting numbers that are helpful to us in terms of learning. Because with our model, we're able over time to assess like the individual success of a company based on those numbers. And at a portfolio level, we now have enough years in the business to be able to show that our predictions are actually leading to the outcomes that we would predict from a portfolio level. So each fund is actually achieving the distribution of returns that we expect based on this methodology. That's why we're doing it on the financial side, right? We're a financially driven first firm. Diversity is one of our investment theses in terms of how we're going to generate superior financial returns. And it also, our process helps to reduce bias because when we look at that market opportunity and we put down these numbers, we can learn from them. And also we can break it down into small enough parts of a decision that bias is less likely to creep in. So if I'm looking at your business model, I'm going to be looking at, if you say you're going to be able to sell to these size of companies, well, we're going to get data on, you know, how many companies of that size are there? How many would pay this kind of money for this product? And it's just a lot less likely that, you know, whether or not you're a woman or a guy is going to have a big influence on this. We know from research that VCs will ask women many more questions about the downside risk of their business, and they'll ask men many more questions about the upside potential of their business. Our process makes sure we ask the same questions of everybody that comes to Ulu, and we're going to look at both the upside and the downside, and we're going to calibrate because sometimes overconfidence is an actual issue. And then sometimes the inability to speak venture and talk a big enough game can be a factor in particular, I think, for diverse founders. And so we want to actually create a process that helps people think about like what could happen, how big could it get, as well as like what could go wrong? Why wouldn't it get to be the size that you expect?
And it goes without saying that this is working, right? You've got a portfolio as diverse as you just described, and you're getting top venture return results by doing it. It's not just something you profess, but something that's actually working.
That's right. It is working and it is generating, top tier financial results. And given that we're seed stage investors, it's not going to happen overnight. But we've been in business now long enough to show that it is working in both funds one and fund two.
Hallelujah. Because when we both started a while back, I don't think there was anyone who could say that, right? That they're getting these kind of results from doing this kind of a strategy and having those kind of diversity numbers. So you're one of very few who have really paved the way and are showing it and essentially saying the water's warm, you know, come on in.
It's great. And I think we are seeing a lot of folks both on the LP side and other GPs were starting to use this kind of thinking, if not in terms of how they actually make decisions, but they're looking at the portfolio construction in a different way, or they're perhaps quantifying their decision-making. And we know that's happened in almost every asset class, right? That people pick stocks in public company stocks with a lot of data. They pick real estate with a lot of data. Very data-driven process as compared to, it's all about the founders is something that you'll hear from a lot of VCs. And I say, yes, there's a lot about the founders, but if your founders are chasing not a great market opportunity or not a big enough opportunity, then it probably won't succeed.
Yeah. Okay. I want to drill down into one more thing here in diversity before we go to mission as an advantage. But I think, let's say you use your approach, which really kind of controls for bias in many ways, but the input into your system is largely homogenous, right? So if you're fair in the way you assess them, but it's a homogenous input, you're going to get a somewhat of a homogenous output, right? In terms of the diversity of the founders. So as far as finding the deals that the founders that you assess at the top of the funnel, like, are there things you do to make sure that the flow is diverse itself? And how do you do that? Because I think there are lots of investors out there who claim, like, well, if I could find diverse founders, if I see them, I'm happy to back them, but I don't see them. And in a way, it's like their job to find them. So how do you fill that top of the funnel?
I want to use an example about how the largest networks are not necessarily the best. The ones that are the best are the most actionable. And from my days at Google, one of the things that we were able to achieve there was to literally build one of the most diverse legal teams in the United States. And I had a call from a friend who had been my boss at a prior company who worked for LinkedIn. And he asked me, how are you doing this? Because we can't find diverse attorneys. And obviously, everybody knows that LinkedIn has probably every attorney in the United States on board. But if you don't know them, it's not all that helpful to have them in their database, right?
Yeah. So that is the problem. So how do you do it as an investor?
It is really like anything else. You actually have to do a lot of work to build your networks and your relationships. And I think a lot of people think that they can do this as a fad, but I'll say that I have been building diverse networks since almost 40 years now, right? In high school, I was involved in organizations that served women and people of color, did the same in college, did the same in graduate school, did the same as an attorney in tech. And so, like, by the time you kind of take a look at what a network looks like, where you have actual relationships with people, I think that's what's going to give you the advantage, if you will, in terms of building a diverse portfolio. We also have tried to be really systematic about sourcing. So, for example, when we were at, one of our focus areas is Stanford University, because I was a first generation college student at Stanford. The network has been incredibly useful and beneficial. And, I feel like I try to pay things back, if you will, in terms of investing in those communities that have really supported me. And we created Stanford Angels Entrepreneurs, and that's now a network of over 1,500 in Silicon Valley that are interested in entrepreneurship and angel investing, and that, are eyes and ears for the Stanford network. But that also is beneficial for us because we can see what our eyes and ears on the street are seeing. And the same thing is true in people of color organizations. My partners have started organizations like Latinx DC and also Latinx MBA. And those organizations have access to, thousands of entrepreneurs and thousands of MBAs.
So when people talk about a pipeline problem, that they don't have a diverse portfolio because the universe of people out there to back is not diverse, I think the short answer is they're just not looking in the right places. Is that close?
Yeah, I would say opportunity is in plain sight.
Well said. Okay, so let's get to the heart of the matter here. Social mission as an advantage. Would you say that Ulu is a mission-driven firm? Would you call yourselves impact investors? How do you describe yourselves and where do you put yourself, the firm, on a spectrum of, you know, like deeply mission-oriented versus sort of straight business as for business sake?
So I will say that I am a very mission-driven individual, and that, as I mentioned, my first career was in the not-for-profit sector. So I'm also oriented around creating change as a personal mission. One of the things that we experimented with our own capital first before we started Ulu Ventures as a fiduciary fund. And so we had the opportunity to invest our own money and risk losing it. And so we did a variety of things, investments that we used to put in our first thing was social positive. Like, we would prefer to do investments that make a lot of money and are socially positive.
Right.
You know, like all things being equal.
If it wasn't socially positive, would you consider passing it over?
And I mean, we won't do socially negative things. But like, I mean, okay, another company that's just a good business that's an enterprise software. Yeah, well, I'll do those every day. I don't know that they're, some of them are socially positive. Like, we've done some of them that have focused on helping companies to provide personal coaching and training in mobile for their next gen workforce. Like, yeah, that feels like a socially positive sort of business. But you know, there's a lot of businesses that are providing like just great accounting services.
Yeah.
You know, so I think all wonderful businesses, and some of them, you know, are probably more pro-social than others. But we typically haven't engaged in businesses where we feel there's a social negative. Like, and partly it's a personal bias. Like, I know there's a lot of people doing cannabis. I don't have anything against cannabis, but I personally find it difficult to think of doing businesses in areas where somebody's, I'm making money off of somebody's judgment or their judgment impairment, and or, you know, any potential psychologically addictive substance.
Yeah,
that's just my personal philosophy.
Got it. All right. So then, do you see your sort of mission or your sort of passion for positive, you know, companies that have a positive impact on society as an advantage for you as an investor? Do you think you're able to relate to founders better, win more investments, get through difficult times with founders because of your mission and your alignment about mission?
I think there's a lot of those things that are really true. One is, I've always believed that in order to make money, you have to actually find investments that are just not going to be ones that everyone else thinks are going to be super successful. It's really hard to make money in a place where everyone thinks like, oh my God, this is like the best thing since sliced bread. Like, what happens? The price gets bid up and that makes the returns very likely to be less.
And they almost always are the ones that disappoint you in the end, after all, after fighting to get into it.
Well, and I find that a lot of the times, you know, areas of investment that are underserved by traditional venture capital are just better opportunities, if you will. So like, you know, we've invested in companies whose primary customer is a not-for-profit, for example. Like FreeWill is a company that helps not-for-profits to have their donors create wills that actually name them in their wills. And, you know, they've probably moved hundreds of billions of dollars into the not-for-profit sector. But people didn't believe that not-for-profits would pay for software. And they might not, except if it's bringing them in money. That's one where they will pay. So I've always wanted to be, you have to be a little bit contrarian in order to be a good investor. And if investing in socially positive businesses is contrarian, then yes, it's been a pretty successful area for us. And I really enjoy those companies personally in some ways the most, because it's really fun to be able to make a difference through the work I do every day. I also think those companies are often able to attract talent that they have no reason to attract except for the social mission of the organization tends to make people feel so excited about working for that company that sometimes they'll take lesser pay. Sometimes they'll walk away from better, bigger companies that have more money and better benefits, and they'll work for our startups. So there's a lot of ways in which I think it supports the advantage of the company.
Now, at risk of getting into trouble here, I'm going to go out on a limb and ask you to contrast yourself with your husband, Clint, because is it fair to say he's a white man and you are a woman of color and you are co-founders of a firm investing, you know, side by side with others? Is there any difference you're seeing in terms of the sort of the pipeline and the success he has and you have in attracting diverse teams? Is this illustrative in any way, or is it maybe a success story that there's really not a difference between the two of you? What would you say? There aren't too many situations where you have, you know, two people like this and you can compare them. It's almost like a controlled experiment where you're in the exact same position side by side, and what happens?
It's so interesting. I will say that unlike other firms, we don't have attribution. But if we were going to give attribution, I would say that, you know, like I'm really have a strength in the sourcing area. And obviously, you know, how they make you try to like define like every step and in the diligence phase and in this and this.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So then it's like I'd be looking at Clint and saying, like, okay, well, he's done some great diligence on every single company that's in our portfolio because he does the decision analysis components for the most part. And then, you know, in terms of legal diligence, well, I do a lot of that. And, you know, like, it's hard to say that one of us would be better or different. What I say is that our founders get the benefit of the complementarity of our partnership. And I think that, you know, for us, we've really learned to play to our strengths and to value the strengths of each other and our other partners in terms of what they do, either in the process of identifying and bringing on great entrepreneurs into the fund. And partly because decision analysis is benefited by our diverse experiences, our diverse skill sets. We have like spaces for conflicts about differences of opinion. And we can use our models to have very different perspectives and also determine whether it's material to whether we'd make an investment decision or not. So the more interesting thing is that sometimes I think it affects founders. I've definitely had guys just like speak only to Clint the entire time.
I'm sure every woman out there can relate to that.
So that happens sometimes, but I could say that might also happen to Clint, where sometimes it's a diverse person and he might feel like that person is speaking to me in the room. So there's some of these realities which I wish were less real sometimes, because, you know, I've worked with guys most of my career. I've been in mostly male dominated fields as a deal maker at Google, for example. I'd say, you know, most of the time I'd be on a deal, I might be the only woman or one of two women, one of them being Joan Braddy, who was like the VP of search for Google, that would be in a transaction regardless of size. And I'm very accustomed to dealing with guys and engineers and people like our entrepreneurs that are men. So I wish sometimes they wouldn't just look at only one person.
So I'd say you just made an argument that similar to diversity being an advantage for operating companies that you're backing, you just sort of made a case for the same thing on the venture side, that by having a diverse team, you're able to make better choices, and not that one of you is better than the other, but that by having different viewpoints and different perspectives and backgrounds, you're going to get better results. You think you get better results and make better decisions.
Yeah. And I would say that, like, you know, some of our most successful white male-led companies, I helped to source. So, right. You know, it's not like it's one way or the other, for sure. But I do really feel like different folks will gravitate towards one or the other of us. And they can be for a variety of reasons. Like, sometimes people feel like, oh, that super analytic approach is something that would be really a compliment to me as a startup founder. And then other people would feel like, I really need more of this EQ or deal or like intuitive decision making, because I'm going to be in a lot of situations where I'm selling to different kinds of customers. And that's a side of my self as a founder that I want to bring out. And I think working with Miriam might help me in that way. So it works in our favor that we have different kinds of people running around here with different areas of expertise. And as a firm, we feel like it's our duty to try to bring all of us to our companies, and that we're going to, you know, like Steve is Mr. Finance. You're going to get Steve if you got a real finance problem. You're going to get Clint if you have some sort of like super horrible data problem. If you have a make or break the company deal, you're going to get Miriam. Like, we're going to try to play as a team for your benefit.
Well said. Let's say, I hope this isn't too hypothetical, but imagine you meet with founders every day, just about, right? At prospective founders to invest in and whatnot. I imagine, take one founder who you ask them why they're doing this, and they say, well, I grew up in Bayview Hunters Point. I noticed all the challenges people had with health and accessing healthcare. My mom actually had a whole crisis because, you know, she couldn't get an appointment or whatever it might be. And this is my life's calling, right? And then founder B, you know, well, I started this photo sharing business, and lo and behold, it's grown like 1,000x over last year. And why am I doing this? Well, because it's going to be really big and it's going to be awesome. How would you evaluate those two? Is that too hypothetical?
No, we probably evaluate each of them exactly the same.
Yeah. Meaning, okay. Oh, right. Of course. That's your model. All right. We'll talk about that.
We would look at each of those companies, do a market map. And, you know, I would say that we'd probably be less likely to look at the photo sharing company in the past because Clint and I were enterprise focused in the past. But now we have a partner, Maria Salamanca, who is dedicated to helping us establish our consumer practice. So she may be have a different perspective on that company. But yeah, we evaluate the opportunity the same. I will say that, you know, you only have a certain amount of time. You only have a certain amount of energy. So we've kind of come up with a very short form napkin decision analysis, which would help us to evaluate whether or not we'd move forward with a particular company. We also know, you know, obviously the photo space would have so much more competition. There'd be other factors that would go into that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we actually look really carefully and have a bit of a methodology around, you know, the founder's personal connection to the problem, the length of time they've been associating with the problem, their sort of lived experience.
Founder product fit is definitely a category.
Right. But I guess, yeah. Is there room in your model to like, would that get captured in your model? Is that a fair thing to be assessing? And is that something that would benefit you as an investor to have as part of or two or three of the things that are in your equation there that you're using?
Yeah, that founder product fit is huge, right? For us, in the sense that it's one of the four factors that we're going to assess throughout the life cycle of a company. And so when I think about it, I think of, does that person's lived experience, training, knowledge that they've had academically, professionally, personally, make them a better person to build this product and to market this product and, you know, to attract talent to help them build this product and make a company out of it? Like, absolutely, that is going to be one of the major factors that we look at from a team risk perspective, is how where all of this would fit in for Ulu Venture. But absolutely, and who doesn't want founders that really have just like an intimate relationship with a problem and a product?
Yeah, indeed. So with regard to social mission, so can you think of an example of a founder where their passion, their sort of a person who you describe as legitimately on a mission? You know, it's about the environment, it's about healthcare, it's about education. Can you think of a time when that type of a founder was more successful because of that passion and that mission, like in raising money? I think, you know, we see it a lot in hiring, but does anything come to mind in your portfolio or in your past experience?
I would say about half of our companies have some sort of socially positive mission aspect to them. And I'm trying to think of some of our maybe more successful companies. and try to identify one in particular. And I mean, some of these companies go through a lot of ups and downs. So I do want to say, like,
They all do.
Ideas, like, for example, Proterra is one of our companies that's a public company now. It was
Electric buses, right?
Electric
school buses, yeah.
And you're probably seeing them in a lot of places where you might get off the airport, or you're in LA and you're in the basin. So, like, some of these companies have ultimately been very successful, but there were points where they were recapitalized, and we came in on one of those recap rounds for Proterra, for example. And, you know, both the CEO and then kind of the CEO who was in place at the time we invested were very mission-driven people. And I think, you know, we expect that most of our companies, if there's a really intimate relationship with a problem or a technology background that is in the space that social problem exists in, they're just going to be better at solving that problem. But in the environment in particular, I think we have companies like Irrigreen, which is using essentially inkjet printer technology to try to water your lawn in a much more cost-effective and waste-free way.
Oh, cool.
I think that'll be a really interesting product. I want to use it.
So you're talking about a sort of an inkjet Roomba that goes, a lawnba that goes around your lawn.
And your lawnba. That would be, they're like a lawnba product. And I think that's an amazing company. Like, everybody can understand, like, why we don't want to waste water. We need to be able to, you know, do this and do it well use the least amount possible. But great company, great founders, a lot of stick-to-itiveness, and, you know, even investors that at one time did elect to have a round that was at a down valuation in order to kind of keep that company going. So it even goes to the investors a lot of the times, right? Like, that people have a real belief in the business and its long-term benefit that goes beyond themselves. And so we see that sometimes working in our favor in terms of being, you know, financially driven first investors, that, you know, when we're kind of able to work with companies and get them over a hump because they do see that our portfolio is very mission aligned and also very rigorous from a financial perspective.
Yep. Okay. So, I want to get to your personal mission here in a minute. What advice would you have for a founder who's particularly, I think a number of people listening are mission-driven founders, and they want to know, when they go out there to raise money, is this something I should be trumpeting, my social mission, or is it something I should be hiding, or somewhere in between? What would your advice be for someone who is deeply mission-driven and they sort of want to gush about it, but they also, they want the money? And they want to be successful. So what would your advice be?
So first of all, do your research, because I think there's sometimes some tells. And I will say that we have the same challenge, if you will, because, you know, there's a movement that says that 1.4% of the money in the world that's invested in firms that are led by women and people of color is too much. And we should roll this back. And that is a movement that is gaining supporters here in the United States. And I think it's a really sad state of affairs. and there's also a movement that's saying, this is ridiculous. 40% of that money came from people of color and women, and we should be investing in the communities and businesses that serve those who contribute to this society. So I'm on that spectrum as a founder myself. And I will say that in general, this is my personal approach. Is I would rather eliminate from my pipeline as quickly as possible those who are unlikely to invest. And so it's helpful for me to be able to be as authentic as possible about what I'm doing. But we are financially driven first. So we do have a lot of alignment with traditional investors, and most of our capital is institutional in nature, but it's for people that are willing to give others a fair shot. And not everyone is. And like I said, even for some people, 1.4% of the wealth in this country being invested in diverse people is too much. And so we run across this, and, you know, in general, we try to identify through research where on, in the spectrum does an investor fall.
Yeah. And I think you're seeing backlash against ESG as well. And I think both that and the group that says that fewer women should be investing in receiving the money are not going to be on the right side of history here.
I think they would be on the wrong side, but
yes, to summarize, the wrong side. So to summarize, do your research, essentially focus on the ones that you think are most likely to buy your pitch, and then be your authentic self. Don't necessarily go out and talk to the ones that you don't think are going to be the best fit for you, and sort of hide your mission or water it down, thinking that that's going to get you the money. Focus on the ones that you think are more likely, and be yourself.
I just think, you know, every salesperson should probably be working this way. Like when I was working at Google, one of our best senior salespeople really focused on eliminating people from the pipeline as fast as he possibly could. And that was a real mindset shift that I hadn't had before I met him, because he felt like if I can eliminate people from my pipeline, I'll be able to focus on the ones that I'm most likely to convert.
Yeah, yeah. That's great advice. Thanks. That's just what we were looking for. Okay, so let's turn to your, as we wrap things up here, let's turn to your personal mission. If I were to say that Miriam is on a mission to what? How would you finish that sentence?
My mission is to live a life that demonstrates that people of color, women, that we can be, we have the potential and can become all that we aspire to. And that's something that's not available often for many people. I want to give people permission to be everything that they can be. I also will say, though, that it is not for oneself only. I grew up with a philosophy that in high school, I was given a scholarship to go to high school. One of the mottos was non-city, not for oneself only. I feel like I've been given a tremendous set of opportunities. I want to give others an opportunity to just achieve, to work, to do the kind of work that they would most like, where their talents can be the most useful. And I want to have people be able to provide for themselves, their family, to have the dignity of self-determination in their lives.
Hallelujah. Miriam Rivera, CEO and Managing Director of Ulu Ventures, on a mission to live a life that demonstrates that people of color and women, that they have the potential to become all that they aspire to. Thanks, Miriam. Great talking with you.
Thank you, Rick.
Thanks for listening to Mission Driven. To find out more about Better Ventures, visit us at better.vc or on Twitter at Better Ventures.